this set up. Okay.
Well, I got discharged at Fort Dix, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I went to Newark, New Jersey. I'd been there before, and it looked nice. And people, you speak to them, and they just ignore you. Over in Europe, everybody was friendly. Everybody spoke to you. It made me almost feel like going back over there. I called my aunt. She was a English professor in the University of New York University, and she lived up on Washington Heights in the west side of New York. I called my aunt. I want to visit her. She said, "You ought to go see your brother." I said, "Where's John? He's my brother. I had a brother and four sisters. And John was 8 years older than me. But he went in the Navy when he was 21. He made a career out of it. And I didn't want to go see him. He insulted me the last time I saw him. And I didn't like what he... And then, so I went over to see him. I said, "I don't know whether I'm going to go home or..." I said, "I got to go home and get my money anyway." And I didn't have any money. And my mother took it. So I went over to see him in Brooklyn Navy Yard. And he taught me. I went up to Binghamton. And I couldn't concentrate. In my business, I was a dental ceramist. And that, you know, it's like a surgeon. You gotta concentrate. You can't be distracted. Very exacting work.
Why couldn't you concentrate?
I was having nightmares. I had nightmares. And when I'd wake up at night, by that time I'd woke up, my adrenaline's pumping, and you couldn't just lay there. What the hell is it? You couldn't sleep. So I'd get up and I'd go for a hike for a couple hours and come back, go back to bed. I annoyed my parents. And I said, "Well, I'll go see my sister in Phoenix, see how it works out there. It's different scenery." And I went out there and I worked for a dental clinic for a while, and I was staying at my sister's, and she same thing. I was waking up, I was having nightmares, still having them, annoying them. So I went out to visit my other sister in California. She was a nurse. I said, "Maybe she'll understand me, won't be so..." But I woke them up and annoyed them, and I said, so I went to Spokane, Washington, and I worked there for a few weeks, a couple of 3 weeks, and I was annoying them. I stayed in a boarding house, $1 a day, room and board. But I was the people thought I was a cuckoo or something, because every night I'd get up and go for a hike. The same thing. I said, "Well, maybe I'll go up to Montreal." I said, "Well, no, let's see." When I went to school in New York, I met all these doctors from Caracas, so they kept inviting me down there. And at that time, I didn't have any money to go down and visit them, but I had it in mind anyway. I thought, "Well, geez, I'll give that a go." So I went down to Caracas. And I liked it down there, but I expected to spend 2 or 3 weeks, and they wanted me to go to work. I said, "I don't have a working permit." And they said, "We'll get you one." In 2 days, I had a work permit. So they were paying twice as much as you could make in the States. And it was great, and I liked it. And Eventually, I got over the nightmares. I guess the change of language and the scenery and the atmosphere and everything. I was there 6 months, and I went up and I met this lady. She lived across the street from my parents in Binghamton, New York. So I pursued her, and she went. She agreed to marry me. And I had a job up in Glens Falls, New York, 200 miles north of there. It was 50 miles north of Albany, New York. And it was an outstanding doctor that had a place there that was terrific. So he wanted me there, and I liked it. It was a little old New England town, then they urbanized it, trashed it. old town, old history. There's a lot of money there. People had made money in paper making and wood like that. There's some paper making plants there where they made the paper for that goes in your money. Mm-hmm. The real high grade paper. And they had a lace factory there. Sundays, we married in November, and this guy, he said, where are you going to get married? I said, oh, probably down at City Hall. No, you're there. I can't do that. You're going to get married in church there. And
which year were you married?
Huh?
Which year were you married?
1947. And that was November. By March, she was pregnant. She said she couldn't get pregnant. She had a tipped uterus. I guess I must have straightened out her uterus. Anyway, she got pregnant. And she asked me, she had married before, and her husband, he was a drunk, and he was cheating on her, everything. And she got pregnant with him, and he made her get an abortion. So she got pregnant. So you want me to get an abortion? I said, what the hell do I know about raising a kid? I came from a dysfunctional family. She said, well, smart. She said, let me help you. She said, all the right things. I said, you're going to have two of us to raise. And she said, no, you'll do all right. And we would have. And it turned out it was everything I ever wanted. I had a good job, beautiful home, by a daughter. I adored them all. And the little girl was the light of my life. I could take her out in the woods in the spring looking for wildflowers. And she said, here's one, here's one, here's one. And it's like looking for finding quarters. Or the wintertime, we'd go tobogganing, or we'd go out. I had a friend that had a wood lot there, and he said, you want a Christmas tree gone? Chop one down. So we went out, and there was a picnic table there, and I says, that's where the teddy bears had their picnic. My daughter says, really? And I used to tell her stories at night. I'd lay down beside her and I'd tell her stories about all the animals, how the skunk got a stripe, and the fox had its white tip of his tail, and the raccoon had a mask on, and I'd tell her these stories. I make them up as I went along, and they were pretty good. She loved it, and I loved it. So one time I bought her, she got out of a training bicycle, the three-wheel job. We got her two-wheel one. And I had it in the car, big, a good size, and I had it in the car, and the driveways in the back end of the house. Margaret came, my wife came down, says, here's a bike for her. So she called her and said, Peggy, Daddy wants you a minute. So she came down. She saw the bike. You know what she did? She threw herself on me. Oh, I loved it. My God, that was beautiful. And then February 1955, I quit smoking. And I went to June. It took me a year to get off of smoking. In June, they told me Margaret had cancer and it had metastasized. It was a loss. Everything I ever wanted was right there. I had it. Not long enough. Not long enough. I wanted it forever. So she died. She lived another 5 years. 1960, she died. Christmas Eve. So my daughter went bonkers. And I had to take her skiing or things like that. So I never skied before. I said, well, I rented the equipment and I tried it and liked it. So I said, well, we'll go skiing weekends and go over to Vermont skiing. Stop on the way home, have a steak dinner. It was good, but she wasn't happy. Neither was I. We lost the light of our life. Eventually, she got married. She did some wild things, but she married. She had a daughter, my granddaughter. She's still alive, Shannon, whom I love very much. When Peggy got married, I said, to hell with it all. I'm going to sell everything. I had a lot of property and I had a good business. I put an ad in the New York Times on a Sunday. Tuesday, a guy came up and bought it. Thursday, he took possession. Man, I went fast. I was ready to junk it all anyway. I was going to go sailing.
What year was this?
That was 1961, 2. And so I had a boat in Catskill. I had a 38-foot catch made in Catskill, and it was custom built. It was a nice job. It was a catch. And I had a freezer on board, and autopilot, good bank of batteries, diesel engine. It was great. But at least I was away from where my life ended, in Glens Falls, New York.
So where did you take the boat?
Well, I went over to Bahamas. If you want beaches, they got the best beaches in the world there. But in the wintertime, and that's when you want to be over there, the hell out of that, they'd get these northerns. They'd come across from Florida, and by the time they got across that water, they were picking up speed. Over here, they may be 20, 30 miles an hour. When they got over the Bahamas, they're at 30 or 40. And you're going from anchorage to anchorage, because you couldn't sail in the high wind like that, because it's very shallow. You go by the color of the water. You had a thermometer on board, but you could tell by the color of the water what the depth of it was. And you'd go aground once. What the hell ever? It's all sand anyway, so what the hell, it didn't hurt anything. And I had the boat hauled twice a year to paint the bottom. I'd clean it off, paint it myself, and have it hauled. And scraper and sand it. I had all the tools. Occasionally I'd have a lady with me. And I met a lot of nice people. It was fun. And I got tired of Northerns over in the Bahamas, and I went on down the Caribbean. And I in the meantime, I met a girl that I cared for. This was several years after Margaret died. And her name was Millie Wood, and she was a singer. Sang Rosie O'Grady's down in Red Hot Mama down in, and she had a most beautiful voice you'd want to hear. Oh my God, it was gorgeous. And we'd been down, at least she came on the boat with me. We went down, we'd go outside, and we'd go east from the Bahamas until we'd get a northwest wind, and we'd go east in the Bahamas for a couple hundred miles until we got into the trade winds, and then that would be out of the east, and then we'd head south. And that would give us a good ride down to Puerto Rico. And we'd go in Puerto Rico and get cleaned up after getting all the salt on us, and clean up the boat. And then we'd go around to Fajardo. We'd go into San Juan. It was nice there. But we'd go around and dock at Fajardo. And then we went over to the Virgin Islands, and that was where the goodies were. Everything was cheap over there. Equipment, electronics, whiskey especially. In those days, you could buy a bottle of a liter of rum for 90 cents. Mm. Good rum. You could buy a bottle of Drambuie for $4.50. And I had the bottom line with that stuff. And we went over, we went down the Bahamas, went down the Antilles, we went over to St. Martin. From St. Thomas, we'd go over to St. John. There's a mountain there you can climb. Go up, you can look over the whole eastern Virgin Islands. You can look over the fires. Is Calibro in Puerto Rico, and it was a nice life. We enjoyed it. Then we'd get down to Venezuela, we'd get down to Antilles, and there's a lot of good places. All stop in all those places, you'd see all friends that you'd cruise with, and they're ahead of you or something, or maybe they're just laying around. And Martinique, you go in there and get couscous. There was one particular restaurant would go in Saturday at noon. They pull the shades down, lock the door. Anybody that was in there would get all the couscous they want for a certain price. And I mean, that was good. It was delicious. You ever have it?
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
They're real good down there, anyways. It's a North African dish, you know.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And we went down to Grenada and St. Lucia. St. Lucia was an interesting place. They had a bay, and halfway down the island, before you get to the Pitons, there's two mountain that look like ice cream cones stuck upside down. And you could anchor in between them there, but it's hard anchoring. You'd have to tie to shore. Surge, and then put an anchor down far enough so it'd be 100 foot down to keep you from going in into the shore. But it was good for a night, and then we'd leave there and go down to St. Vincent. In St. Vincent, that we went ashore there, and there was a botanical garden there, and it had one of the breadfruit trees that Captain Bligh on the Mutiny on the Bounty had brought there, one of the original ones. Mm. It was quite interesting. There's a lot of history through these islands. One of the places there in San Juan, or Santo Domingo, you'd go around on the east side of Santo Domingo, there was a bay that went in, it called Samana. And it would go in 30, 35 miles. It was about 5 miles across. And I had a cruising guide. I had a couple of different cruising guides that told you what to expect in different places and how the anchorage was and how the people were. One place they told you not to go is Trinidad. Another place is Jamaica. They get ripped off there. So we didn't go there. Yeah, and Angie, I finally met. She was from Trinidad. But anyway, we go in. It told a story in this cruising guide about an 1834 or 1838. There was a sloop called the Turtle Dove. There was an escaped slaves on there from the Carolinas. And they got blown in there by a storm, and they blown ashore. And communication being what it was in those days, it was 50 years before the Dominican Republic, Santo Domingo, knew that they had a Negro-speaking colony. And and the black people are still there. Their name's Jones, Williams, or whatever. You know, they speak Elizabethan English. It's interesting. These books, you get all history all through the place. One place we went was Nevis. Nevis was just a round ball of land, and the winds or the surge from the eastern. You're right in the trade wind, so your surge was out of the east, and it carried around that island there, and it was heavy, and it would dislodge your anchor. But we went in there, and I was going to fly out of there to another little island that had another ice cream cone at the top. You could fly in there on a small plane, and you got good weather reports. They had way at the top of that, they had an antenna up there, and they got weather stations that you got there. Yeah, it's good. But Nevis was the center of commerce in the Antilles in the Caribbean in the 1800s or the 1700s, and they had American man of war went in there and got 21 gun salute from them. They loved us. Still do when they're treated right. And so Nelson came up from Antigua and blew the island apart. He leveled it. It was where the first synagogue was too. There was Jewish people there. There was a lot of commerce. It put the place out of business. They never had anything after that. It lost it. And it was, what a shame it was. The old building, you see the buildings are still there, crumbled, and from more that had been blown apart by the British. And so we went down through there. We went up to St. Kitts. And there was a called there's a mountain there, and it had all fortifications all around there, and that was where the it was a French owned island, and that's where the French admiral took those the guns from there, took them up to Washington at Valley Forge, and the French had a regiment fighting with him too, so you know if it wasn't for the French we wouldn't have had our country. So be kind to the French, they were good to us, and I can go over there today and I feel I have more in common with the French than I ever did with the British. I like them. I like the French. I like France country. So anyway, we'd get down to Venezuela, and Venezuela was a nice place. That was before the present dictator down there. They had a semblance of a democracy at that time, and you'd go in there and buy diesel fuel for 9 cents a gallon, gasoline for your jerry can for your dinghy motor was more. That was expensive. That was 15 cents a gallon. You could buy a lomito. That's a whole tenderloin for $9 to $10, maybe 12 if it was big. And you get, you got. The food there was as scrumptious. When I left from there, I had a freezer full of steaks. Filet mignon. Good. The best. And I liked the people down there. We met some, I met a doctor, a General Black. He had commanded the Air Force down there. He got retired. And he was a general, and he commanded the Air Force in Venezuela. He was from Trinidad. He was English. And he had a sailboat. That's why how I met him. And he and his wife they're lovely people. He didn't know much about boating. When he retired, he had a $35,000 pension. Well, by the time they got through devaluing that Bolívar, the unit of currency down there, to the present time, that $35 was 35 cents. And he owned some property. He owned a couple of condos up here in Florida, and he owned one down on the beach in Puerto La Cruz. And they were nice people down there.
How did you learn how to sail?
When I was at Glens Falls, there was a big lake nearby. It was 35 foot long. And in the wintertime, it would freeze over. And you could drive cars on it.
Was this Lake George?
Lake George.
Yeah.
You know?
I've been there, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I skated the length of that one year.
Wow.
I was good at skating. I used to race for silver skates. I was good.
So you learned to sail on.
I had a couple of boats up there. I had a power. I had 21 foot Lyman lap strake sided boat that would do 55 miles an hour flat out, just leave a streak behind you, I tried skiing behind that one time, and if you don't do it right, you're gonna fall. If you fall, it's 55 miles an hour. Even in the water, you're gonna get hurt, or you'll feel it anyway. So I never did that again. I skated on that lake, there was a sailboat, ice boats. They were there, and they'd throw me a sheet line behind them, and I'd hang out of that, and then go across, and I could tell the speed between the distances between islands. And they were up to over 70 miles an hour, and I was hanging on that, going over, there's ice floes in there. I had, it was interesting. You could skate over the lake, and the ice was so black and clear, you could look right down to the bottom. The lake was formed by glaciers, and there's rocks down there as big as houses, and you could look right down and see lake trout, big 2 or 3 foot lake trout swimming underneath the ice there. Oh, my. There was a guy I knew was in Glens Falls, and he was an insurance adjuster. And he called me up at night, and he says, the bread truck had just came down from Saratoga. They came over Tongue Mountain. He could look down in the narrows, and the narrows, they used to get pack ice. And the pack ice would be up, and then there'd be open leads around it. You couldn't skate through there. So this one time, it was flat out, no pack ice. And he says, I'd like to go up with you. You ought to go with me. And I said, I'd be delighted to. And he says, one of us could drive up to the head of the lake, and the other could pick us up down to Lake George Village. So my wife drove us up to Ticonderoga, We got up there at 10 o'clock in the morning. We skated at 3:30 in the afternoon down there. The wind was on our back, the sun was on our front, and we'd chew on candy bars, and it was such a pleasure. If you turned to go into the wind, boy, you really felt it. And one time I'd been down, it was wintertime, and they would get leads in the ice, and I was skating, and I was up by Plum Point on Lake George, and there was ice, and it separated, and it froze in between, but it wasn't heavy, but you couldn't tell. And I went under that, and I went into the water head first, and it was zero. And I cut my face, you know, on the ice, and I was bleeding, and my hair was, everything was all ice on me. I looked like the Abominable Snowman. So I skated down to my car. My daughter was in the car, and I didn't want to walk. I had to walk across the sidewalk and across cement and stones, and I didn't want to ruin my skates because they were expensive. I had expensive skates. And I got down on my hands and knees and crawled over. I got to the door where my daughter was. Next on the door, she looked down, and I thought she's gonna scream or something. I was bleeding, snow on me. So she opened the door, and I got in the car without ruining my skates. And I couldn't even take them off there because everything was froze up. And I got home and I took a hot tub and a hot cup of tea with a shot of scotch in it. I never even got a cold.
Getting back to the Caribbean, how long did you sail around in the Caribbean for?
I was in the Caribbean for 16 years. Uh-huh. But we would go back every so often if I needed some. I had to get I forget what it's called now. It's where your manifold goes off into this air box where it had to be replaced. It was leaking, and I was getting carbon dioxide in the boat. So I was going. I had to go back to Florida. So we, Millie was with me at this time, and we'd gone down. It took us 8 days from the Bahamas to go outside and down to Puerto Rico, and it was great. We had little birds. They're lost. Got lost offshore. They landed on our deck. And we put out sugar water for them, but I'm sure they died. But anyway.
Would you attribute your wartime experiences to this love of adventure and wandering?
No, I think I was happy being a father and a husband to Margaret. Mm-hmm. And I would have stayed there the rest of my life if she had lived. I wouldn't have left. It was because of Margaret. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't we all think about things like that. I know I had a chance to go out when I was a kid one time. A guy owned a freight schooner or a sloop. A sloop is the opposite of a catch. A catch, the main mast is in the front, and the mizzen mast, the shorter mast, is in the back. And a schooner, the main mast is in the back, and the shorter mast is in the front. And usually they're gaff rigged. That means the top of the sail has a boom that goes out on there. They don't go. They go downwind good, but they don't go down. They don't sail to windward good. But it was an interesting life, and I had prowess with Peggy. Margaret died. I come through the war. I said, "Damn it! I got to do something." For myself once, so I'm gonna go sailing. So I always wanted to, and I had a small sailboat on Lake George, And that's where I took a correspondence course in celestial navigation and coastal navigation. So I was completely ignorant of what was going on. And in those days, I knew how to use a sextant. But when I got out there, and after I'd been out there a year, they had sat navs, and that was a predecessor of the GPS that they have today. The GPS came in after I quit sailing. I like to navigate. To me, it was a great thrill to go off at night and bring up your target right on target and the next morning. It was a challenge. It was great. I loved it.
Were there any moments where you were in danger?
I'm coming to it.
Okay.
And so going back, we had the current with us, and sometimes the wind, usually the wind. Going down, you went outside and down, so that you because going down through the islands, you'd have the wind against you. So I got to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
I learned the rudiments of sailing. Besides the powerboat, I had a 16-foot sailboat on Lake George. And then I took lessons, celestial and coastal navigation and so forth. And when you go out on the ocean, previous to going out on the ocean, you buy charts. Every place you're going to go, you don't go any place that doesn't have a chart. Even on Lake George, small lake, 35 miles long, 5 miles wide, you have charts. Because there can be some rocks. And if you're, you don't trust the, you have to have charts. And then you have a pedometer on board there. And I had a sat nav, and that's an instrument that would, the satellites would go over. I think there's about 8 of them up in the air. And about every 5 or 6 hours, one would go past, and then and registered on your instrument there, and it sound off, and it lets you know that it received a fix and position. So you go down, correct your position, put it wherever it indicates. It gave you your latitude and longitude, and then you'd mark it on your chart, and then you kept a log too of where you were and how you were and all that. So I had to go back and get this exhaust replaced. So. We thought Millie was with me, and we weren't married. I might have married her, but she had a big family, and they were all freeloaders, and I could see that it had been the same thing with me, so. Millie and I, we got the boat fixed there and provisioned up, and we went down West Palm Beach, Riviera Beach. We go across, you go out there, right at Riviera Beach, there's an opening out, and you go out that, and you go out at dark, at probably about 11 or 12 o'clock to make the other side. Now, you have a current. The Gulf Stream is right offshore there. You're right in a 5-6 knot Gulf Stream, and you have to, that's 90 miles. You want to go 90 miles right directly opposite you, right east. But to get there,
where is this, in Florida or?
Going out of Florida, going out of Riviera Beach to go across to West End in the Bahamas, mm-hmm. on the Grand Bahama Islands. And you'd have to steer, instead of 90 degrees, you had to put a correction in. You're going through the water sideways. You had to put a correction in for the for the current, because you and so you sail about about 100 degrees, say 100, 105 degrees, and that, you're sailing that way when you want to go that way. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
And that's the challenge of sailing that I like. I like that. And being right the next morning was. And then when you get over there, you'd anchor in, and you're supposed to go in through customs. But if you don't get off the boat, and there's no reason to get off the boat there, you'd stay there. You'd anchor there at night and rest. And then the next morning, you'd go down around. You'd go down along the island. And down at the lower end of the island, a west end, there's a loading platform for oil vessels, big oil. There's a refinery there, and it was offshore, so that these vessels could come right up to that loading platform. They made high grade distillates like kerosene, gasoline, or aviation fuel, and like that. They took it. They sold it all in Europe, So we get down around there and go into Lakaya, and spend a night there or so, because the next jaunt to go from there to the Barrier Islands is about 90 miles, and so you have to back off. You take your chart, you take your calipers. 5 mile, you figure out the distance and how you're going to do it, and the wind is with you and all that, and you may make allowances for the wind and the current, and to get down there in daylight, so that you're not going to approach it at night. And when you go down there, there's an anchorage in there. And you go in, and it's the top Barrier Island. Barrier Islands. Barrier Islands were all recluseful places. Really lovely. There's an acreage down halfway down there where it's just like South Pacific. Now they got houses and docks and everything else in there. It's beautiful before. And that's... So you go from there, it's about 40 miles down to Nassau. But one time I stopped in at this one place where it was like frozen alder key. That was the name of it. That was and I caught a fish, and I misidentified it, and I got Secateurs. Do you know what Secateurs is? Mm-hmm. Fish poisoning. Okay. I had malaria. In the Army, I had malaria 8 times. I would rather have a case of malaria than Secateurs. Secateurs takes you 5 weeks or more to get over it. There's no cure for it. When you lay down, it's fish poisoning. When you lay down at night, your toes and your tip of your fingers are tingle, and you get all these weird feelings, and there's nothing you can do to help it. And I saw a doctor down. I got down to. I got that. I caught this fish in the Barrier Islands. I ate it in Nassau. Then I went on down to Georgetown, down to Exuma's, and I put in there. And there was a doctor there, and he says nothing you can do. I understand now that they do have something, but it was. I stayed there a while till it let up some, and then I went down to the Turks and Caicos, and I went into Providenciales. And Providenciales is a nice place. I went in there and stayed a week. From there on, it was over 125 miles to Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be sick going down there. You better be well. So I stayed in there for about a week. By that time, it had been 5 weeks. And I was pretty well over it. I was a little emaciated, but I was all right. I used to. Cook, you keep when you provision a boat out at sea, you, potatoes, onions, you hang them up on a net, up on a from the bimini up on your deck there. The air keeps them deteriorating. And bananas, whatever, it's everything. So Millie and I had done this before.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do that again to go. It's the motor to go down through. You have to if the wind is, unless you got a northeast wind, which is not always, you're gonna have a tough slog down going through the islands. So you try to go outside, wait for a northern, make it outside, go east 200 miles, then head, by that time you'll be in the trade winds, then you'll head south. And we put in the Davis Harbor on Eleuthera, southern tip of Eleuthera. And
which year was this?
Huh?
Which year was this?
I think it was 1988.
Okay.
And I called before we went out. It looked threatening. Everybody, most of the people were staying in there. They were all going to go down the same way, but they stayed put. So I went out the phone where there's a phone and I pay phone and I could call. I call the airport in Nassau and I got the meteorologist. I asked him what's the story on the front going through, and he says it's supposed to be 15 to 20 gusting to 25 out of the north northwest, which would have been just right to go east. We got out there. And it was 40 to 45, gusting to 55, full-blown gale. Well, we were riding it all right. I had a working jib, just a working jib to keep the head into the wind and forward. So. And I quartered the seas so that you don't pitch pole fear. But so we were riding it good. It was great. And I was making too much headway. I was going down the slopes of the waves. The waves are probably about 15, 20 foot. And you're going down a slope or a wave there. You don't want to go down too fast. And so I had to take off the working jib and replace it with a storm jib. And I told Millie, I said, when I get outside, I'm going to stomp on the hatch and you're going to untoggle it. You're going to hand me up the storm jib and I'm going to hand you down the working jib. And I went forward. I didn't have a lifeline on, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I stomped on it. She handed it up to me and I went forward and I already unhooked the working jib, and I hanked on the storm jib. I had to go back to the mast to get it up, raise it up, and it wouldn't go up because one of the toggles was fouled, and so I had to go forward to unfoul the toggle. I had followed the toggle and I was about ready to turn around and go back to the mast, and the boat lurched. I mean, when I say lurched, it's so hard that it threw me over the side. I went over to the left side of the boat. There's two lifelines on the boat. I always make sure that those things, I hang on to make sure there's a test before I go out on a, and I, just as I was going over, I caught the top lifeline with my right hand. As a consequence of that, later I tore out my tendon up there. And anyway, I was hanging there like that, over the side, and I thought, you know, all I have to do is let go and get rid of all this crap, the war, death. I said, I can't do that to Millie. She'll go bonkers. So I got to get back aboard. I was thinking of how to get my foot over the tow rail and climb through the lifelines, get back forward. Before I could do anything, the boat lurched again, threw me right back on the deck, right exactly where I came from. I got down on my knees. I wasn't going to stand up on that one. And I got down on my knees and I hung on the lower lifeline all the way around the deck till I got to the cockpit. That was one of my tough ones. Why I'm alive today, I do not know. The things that happened to me, I wasn't scared. I didn't feel that, you know, I said, what the hell? I wasn't afraid of dying. But I got back down there, and Millie was down below. She was down in the cabin. I put in the boards and pulled the hatch cover shut. And I could hear a roar behind me, and it sounded like, and it looked like a line storm. That precedes a storm. Hell, we were in the middle of a storm. We was in a full-blown gale. There were graybeards out there. Graybeards is when the scud gets froth on the top of the waves. And it was confused seas. This later they tell me now that that's the... that'll tell you when... I want to turn off now. Ready, set, go. Don't take life too serious. You're not going to get out of it alive.
You're right.
So this line storm was coming down on us. I thought it was a line storm. It wasn't. It was a rogue wave. It was a 30 to 40 foot wall of water straight up and down. I was in the cockpit alone. I wasn't tied in again. Millie was down below. And it hit the boat. It took me 2 months to come to the realization that I was knocked unconscious. But I got... later, I found I had a hole in my head right through the skull here. And in my back, there was one right through to the vertebrae. And in the back of my legs, I'd been pushed by that mountain of water. And water is not soft. Mm-hmm. It's hard, especially when it hits you like a brick wall. And I had holes in my back and my legs, my back of my head, my skull. When the boat rolled over 360 degrees. And how I recognized that I was unconscious is that I didn't remember anything from the time that wall of water hit till I could look out and see the keel. Even on the horizon, the keel's supposed to be underneath you. And it wasn't just a few seconds later that and it snapped. I mean, a good distinct snap when the boat righted itself. The boom was bent, sails were tore out. The motor had water in the injectors. It was a diesel. You don't run on water. I was with no way in God's green earth we were going to get that back to Florida and salvage it. Stanchions were bent. Everything was, the sail was tore out. I could see a light off in the distance. And so I took stock of it. Millie was with me. the dinghy got tore out, hanging over, was hanging by the lead halyard on the front of it, dock line, and we got that back aboard. It was full of water, and I was a pretty strong guy in those days. I wasn't afraid of anything. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about anything else. I just what the situation presented itself to me right there. How do you resolve it? That's what it's about. Whether it's war or sailing, anything else. So I went down on the radio and I called Mayday. I said, this is the catch Nani. Nani come from a Welsh word, means we or us, the Welsh.
Okay.
I named all my boats Welsh word. So I told him, I said, we just got rolled over, we're disabled, and we're no way in God's green earth we're going to get this thing back to Florida, and we're gonna just, and it was taken out of water, and so we're going to have to abandon the ship. So we took what I had. I had couple of $1,000 in cash, and I got that out of my hiding place down below and put it in my pocket. And he wouldn't come close. It was called a Container Trader is the name of it. It was about 250 foot, small boat, and it was in ballast. That means it was upright out of the water. And the guy wouldn't come near me. I asked him to come near me, and he wouldn't come near me. The guy was a German guy. He had an accent. He spoke English with an accent. He would probably was a good Nazi. He told me later that he would never answer another Mayday. The men volunteered. He didn't ask them to, but they volunteered. They went over the side. They had a hold of Millie, and I gave her a Class A life vest, and she was big chested anyway. And a Class A life vest is thick, big. It'll keep you afloat forever. And I had one of those old Yachty's on, which is just for short time. But that she should have had one. Anyway, they had a ring, a life ring. They left over. They couldn't get it over her head, but they should have untied the damn ring, tied it to her life vest, and pulled her up. She drifted off. I mean, they had her. They had her. And then she drifted off. So I had to swim for it from my boat. I had to swim for it. He wouldn't come any closer. I had to swim. Boy, it was as far as from here over to that road that goes up that way, right through there. Can you see it?
Mm-hmm.
And these are heavy seas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a gale, big seas. And I got over to him. And the boat was rolling, and when it rolled, it was in ballast. Anyway, it was, it had a boarding ladder, but it was, I couldn't reach it until the boat rolled. When the boat rolled towards me, I could grab the rung of the ladder. So I pulled myself up with that. And I got up in there, and I had the shivers. I was exhausted physically and emotionally. And he left, went off, and left the Millie there, the son of a bitch. And it was about 2 days from there to Miami. He went up the inner passage, right up, right right between Barry Island and Grand Bahama Islands. He went just due east over there to Miami. And when he got the Coast Guard, when he got me aboard, he got the Coast Guard on there. And the Coast Guard made him put me on the radio to talk to him, because sometimes these guys get mad at you. They got to go out of their way and they throw you over the side because they don't want the trouble of getting you ashore. And so the Coast Guard talked to me and identified me, and they were going to meet me out at Nassau or in Miami, and coming up all the way there, there was a north wind there, and boy, it was the boat would vibrate, it would shudder, all the way up there. Jesus Christ, the little old sailboat rode better than that. And then I the Coast Guard came out. At first, I was thinking about jumping over the side of the water and let them pick me out of the water. But I went down the ladder, and they got up close, and I waited. The boat rolled, and then I got dropped into the Coast Guard boat. They took me ashore, and they wanted me to come out here. They had a place. They had here I was exhausted, soaking wet. And they were going to they wanted to know from the Coast Guard when I was on the boat there about Millie. And I said, Millie's gone. This bastard let her fly off, let her drift off. If you want to charge her with murder, I'll testify to that effect. So I wasn't too popular with the captain. And so they wanted to know who her next of kin was, and I gave her her family's name in Orlando like that. And when I got to shore, they had called, her family had called this friend of her, of Millie's, and he was a chief of police down in Miami. And he came down, took me up to his house, and I got in his house there. I took a hot shower. There wasn't any way I could sleep. And I got out and I just went for a hike. I wanted to go to a motel and get a bottle of booze and get drunk and go take a hot shower and go to bed. But I had to go through this goddamn routine. And so the Coast Guard had, the TV came down there and had light my face. They were going to interview me about this thing. And I said, look, I am exhausted emotionally and physically, and I'm soaking wet, and I don't feel like standing here and chatting about a life and death happening. So please cut it off. So at that point, the Coast Guard got cheated out of a story. They were probably but paid for it. I don't know. So it tells you how Coast Guard thinks. They weren't thinking about me. They were thinking about themselves. And the next day, I had my money there, and I flew up to Orlando, or I took a bus up or something. I got to Orlando, and I rented a car. I had cash. I told the guy in the car there that I didn't, you know, what the story was, and I had cash, and my glasses were gone. I called my optometrist in Winter Park. And he made me up a pair of glasses right away. So I went up there and I had glasses, because I'm blind without them. And they're having a memorial service for Millie. I mean, Jesus Christ, they don't, to me, I don't know, memorial service. She, maybe she's still alive, I don't know. At that point, who the hell knew? The son of a bitch's memorial service. The last thing I wanted to see. So I got my car and her son, she never trusted him. He used to steal from her when she gave him a carte blanche to get in her bank account or her house and stuff there. He wasn't trustworthy. So anyway, I wanted my stuff. She had her stuff in storage and I paid her part. I paid her half of that storage and we both shared it. I had stuff there too, and I went in there. I mean, I was confused and everything, and it was a little upset. And he said, "Well, you got enough. You got stuff there. There was other stuff in there that I wanted. I had some paintings, valuable paintings. They took. I never got them back. They stole them. Her kids stole everything of mine. Worth anything. But I had a bank account there with money in it, so I went and got my glasses, got some clothes, went out to this thing there, and I lingered around Orlando a while, and needless to say, Millie had six kids, two boys and four girls, and they were spongers. And I killed their mama for them, in their opinion. Did you open that up?
Yeah.
No.
So I was there a week or two and got some clothes and I said, I can't stay here. Her children ignored me. Matter of fact, her friends ignored me. And she had a lot of friends there. But I said, I go to Caracas. Good old Caracas. So I went down there and I stayed in a hotel called the El Cid up in Altamira. Nice section of town. A nice motel. Had a porch out there, a balcony. And I could sit in the sun. And there was a steakhouse next door. I'd get on there and eat. I'd walk around. And anyway, I went in the steakhouse and here's a bunch of girls in there. And they're all speaking English. And I said, gee, it's seems nice to hear English spoken for a change. And they looked at me and Owen. And when they broke up, the one girl came over. She was Indian. Her name was Angela Budasing. And we got to be friends. She took me home with her, and we made out and all that. It was nice. She was a nice girl. I still love her. She used to denigrate me. I saw what my mother did to my father, and nobody's going to do that to me. I'll walk away from him, do something. So I told her, I said, Angie, you keep doing that, I'm going to. She only did it mostly when her family was around. I married her, you know, see, and then I after I married her, I got her citizenship. I this is stupid reasoning. Romantic. I don't know what the hell you want to call it. But I come to, after I lost Millie, I said, I got to do something for womankind. So here's Angie. Her boyfriend had just died on her. And she was unhappy and she was about as bad as I was. So I brought her up here. I didn't love her, but I liked her. And she was good company. She was a lot of fun. We'd go up to the racetrack, and Sunday morning, go over to this place called Attica. That means the attic in Spanish. And there was a guy from Boston that owned it. It had, it was out, kind of like a balcony out there, and you could sit there and have breakfast and had the newspapers there, and it was beautiful. And he always made a popover. He had a big popover. Guy knew how to make popovers. And then we'd go up to the racetrack. And if you bet and lost every race, you wouldn't lose $20. But I used to like to watch Angie. She'd go up by the cashier's cage and listen on what they're betting on. And she, you know, big thrill to her to know what to bet. We used to bet. We won. Maybe we'd play 8-10 races, would win maybe 7-8. Didn't make any money, but it was fun. Mm-hmm. She was a fun person. She had a car. Her past boyfriend there that died, he was a millionaire. He owned a chemical factory there, and he was Italian. He had a doctor in chemistry, and he bought her the car. She was... And bought her, she was married before she divorced the guy. She had married a German guy. And all those Germans down there are all ex-Nazis. They go to South America or something to get that. They couldn't come to the States. And she divorced him. And she was living with this guy. She thought he would divorce his wife and marry her, but he wasn't going to do that. Angie was a beautiful girl. She was Miss Trinidad at one time. She came from Trinidad, but she spoke Spanish, Italian, French, English. She spoke about 7 languages, 6, 7, I don't know. She's a bright girl. She was an executive secretary for an American geophysical company. And so I brought her to the States, and I got her. So at one time there was I got her citizenship, and we had a chance to buy a boat. We were down at Fort Lauderdale, and we saw this boat, the last one I had. And so I said, you want to go out to sea with me? I mean, you know what happened to Millie? Oh, you're not going to let that happen to me. And she was right. She wouldn't go outside. She would go down through the islands. So there was a boat down there. It was 2 years old. It sold originally for $180,000. It had all kinds of equipment on there. And it didn't have a freezer. And I put a freezer on it and an autopilot. And it had every, it was 43-foot sloop, double spreaders. It was a big boat, big mast. And so we took it up to, from there we took it up the waterway to Daytona. And we had it hauled to Daytona because I knew the place and I could get the work done. And I could get it done. I got it bottom painted and all re-equipped and fixed up, ready to go take the sea. We're going back down to Caracas. And going down through the islands. And so, we got to have a name for this. I documented it. You know, you go through the Coast Guard to document it. You don't get a state license. The state license, you get all kinds of trouble going to customs in other countries. So you document it, and it's cleared by the Coast Guard, and they won't bother you. Mm-hmm. So I said, Angie, we got to have a name for this boat. And I had a Welsh dictionary, and I said, here, you pick out the name. So she picked out the name Cariad. Well, Cariad in Welsh means darling or love. So Cariad it was. And we took off. We went down. And she's a gregarious person and got along fine with people. The only time she'd denigrate me was when her family was around. Mm-hmm. I think she was ashamed of being married to an old man. That was a conclusion I came to. Her sister couldn't understand it either. She used to come over. Her sister lives in England. No, I've been over there. I know her. I know Lorna. They're nice people.
Can I ask you a question about the present? Not to cut you off, but was there more to this story?
What's that?
Well, I had a question about more recent wars in U.S. history and your impressions of those wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I don't think we belong in Korea. It wasn't my, I don't believe we belong in Korea. I don't think, and I know we didn't belong in Vietnam. Panama was, we were just throwing our weight around. Who was that, Bush Senior, went in the Panama. And then he also went in the Grenada. And went in the Grenada. The first time I went there was on Carriad, and it was right after that, and you could see the place was all shot up. And there were Cubans in there, and they gave them and in the southern end of the island, in Grenada, there was an anchorage in there shaped like a hourglass. And going through that narrow part, it showed on the chart that it was about 6 foot. We went through there. It had been opened up, made wider, and 40 foot deep. They're making it ready for the Russians to use it for a sub pen. It's only explanation for it, because the fishing boats had been going in and out of that place without that. So we did. Anyway, that's not Grenada, but the first Gulf War down there, I think, was necessary because Hussein was, he took over Kuwait, and his next stop was going to be Saudi Arabia, and that would have cut off our oil. And it would have called, if you think this times are tough now, then you would have had real tough times because there would have been no oil coming out of there to us. And in a way, I think that was Swyskov went down there. He was a masterful tactician. They thought he was going to go down through Kuwait and like that. He went down through Jordan, and they were right on. They didn't know that he was there, I guess, and so he just cut them right in two. He cut off their supplies. They went in there and they were all dug in trenches, and they took bulldozer, went and buried them alive in there. Some people I heard them say, oh, that's terrible. What the hell? What's terrible? War! War is terrible! War. So anyway, Swyskov did a good job. I admire Swyskov. He did a good job. But if he had any smarts, they would have let him go on up to Baghdad, cleaned out Hussein, and then left there. Going into Afghanistan, I can understand it going in there. That's where they came from when they hit those twin towers in New York. But a smart president would have had the FBI and the CIA talking to each other, which they weren't doing. And they would have had the information, and they would have picked those guys up before they could have blown up the Twin Towers. So I can excuse them for going into Afghanistan. But going into Iraq, there was absolutely no reason to go in there. I couldn't understand. I didn't think he was going to do it. Because that was stupid. There were no threat to us. There were no threat to us in Afghanistan. And I would have left them alone. He was sucked into a trap there, and he didn't, he had no, made no Bush should be, he lied about weapons of mass destruction. He should be taken before a grand jury and made to explain why he lied about weapons of mass destruction. And he should not be allowed to walk away from this, what he did. Because if he does, then there's going to be guys down the line, other presidents going to do the same damn thing. And that's wrong. And they've all been doing it ever since World War II. Now, World War II, they attacked us at Pearl Harbor. I didn't need to be told to go in. I volunteered the next day. And I wanted to be in. And I got the back to England from Sicily, and my major Mike Cowell said, "Dick, I got to put you in a dental clinic at Cheltenham, and if you like it, you can sit out the war there. If you don't like it, you can come back." Did I tell this story before?
Yeah.
Well, I won't burden you with that.
Okay.
I don't get old. You repeat yourself. But I do have it up there though. But anyway. I think Bush is a criminal. I think he's a criminal. What he did was he destroyed Iraq and it cost 100,000 lives. He destroyed the United States economically and cost us 4,000 lives. There's a book I read about that. The guy, he was the prosecutor in California, the Manson people.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book about trying Bush for murder. Did you read it?
No, I haven't, no.
Well, it's good.
Yeah.
I read it. My friend Don Orlando mailed it to me, and I read it. And he laid out all how they could try him. He should be taken before a grand jury and made explain and try him for murder. And not let him keep his goddamn pension or anything else. They got to penalize the son of a bitch.
Many people draw a comparison between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. Do you think that comparison is valid?
No. No. Pearl Harbor, they knew they were threatening. But they went in there without them knowing it. They didn't know where the hell they were. And if they had, they could have taken Pearl Harbor. They could have taken the Hawaiian Islands. And if they had taken the Hawaiian Islands, or even I read a story about one of the, Bull Halsey. Bull Halsey, we had oil reserves, thousands of barrels of oil reserves in Hawaii. And if they had hit those and taken those out of there, He said he would have abandoned Hawaii because there'd been no way that they could have defended that place. They couldn't. They had no reserves there. Pearl Harbor was down there. Those Iranians that attacked us there were outlaws. They didn't represent any government. There was no government that they represented. They were outlaws. You couldn't compare that to Pearl Harbor. Japan attacked us.
And recently, President Obama signed an executive order to close Guantanamo. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, yeah, because in Guantanamo, it's outside the continental limits of the United States, and they can use terrorists. They can torture the son of a bitches down there, and they get away with it. Whereas I'd close it for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, send them out, send them back where they came from, or bring them up here and put them in jail out here.
Mm-hmm.
No, they shouldn't be in this rendition and torture, and they were guilty of torture too. I mean, they're There's plenty of people have talked about it. So I gotta finish this sailing.
Okay.
Is there something else you want to ask?
Nope, that's it.
Do you agree with me?
I do, yeah. But my opinions don't matter as much as yours for the purpose of this interview.
Why?
Because I'm trying to gauge your opinion. So.
Well, that's my opinion.
Okay, good.
I mean, if they had tried them, brought them to the States and tried them, or if they had tried them in a civil court down there, because these people were not representing a country. They were outlaws. Mm-hmm. And they still are over there.
Yep.
They're going to, if they're care, and anyway. Oh, well, let's get on with the boat. Angie made a lot of friends on the carry-on. We got over in the Bahamas and Nassau, and there's places in there where we get dinghy around. And it was, they had a Club Med there. You go over on the beach at Club Med, and they're topless and all that. That's nice. The French Islands are all topless. They were good. That was great. I loved to look at women's. I don't think in all the world there's anything more beautiful than a woman's body. We were evolved wrong. We were evolved wrong. But anyway, Angie made friends, and we're kind of, you'd make friends in Nassau, and you get out of Georgetown and the Exumas, and they're down there. Mm-hmm. Or you'd go into Allen Key. From Nassau, you go right across there to Allen Key, and there's iguanas in there. And you go in, and you could go inside. It's like a coral reef, you know. You go inside and anchor, it's safe, you know, and go ashore, take some bread with you, and feed the iguanas. They take it out. Angie loved it. She had a great time, and she made friends, and she loved it. And we went down to Georgetown, and those people down there, those women made pineapple upside down cake that was out of this world. And I don't remember what it cost, $4 or $5, $3 or $4, some, I don't know. Well, it was scrumptious. I always bought one. Georgetown has a big anchorage out there. There's a lot of islands on both sides. There was an opening in there, and it was a nice place. It was a fun place, and you'd run into people that you've met other places, and I'd met them before when I had money, and I had a lot of friends there. If you found a had a friend use and they had trouble with their boat and they needed work on it, you'd give them a hand. Mm-hmm. And I had them do that for me also. The people in those days were very friendly. Mm-hmm. And very helpful. Might cost you a bottle of rum when I got through, but that's a cheap price to pay for getting help. So and we went down through all the islands, and we'd go over to, from St. Thomas, when you go in the harbor of St. Thomas, well, we'd anchor at Water Island. That was separate from the St. Thomas itself. There was anchorage, and there's hotels on this place, and there was on the west side, there's anchorage there, you know. And the water was more or less clean, and you get out in the harbor in St. Thomas, and you put your anchor over, and it was so dirty, it was so filthy, that you'd get out in the morning, you go ashore, do your shopping, come back out, maybe you go into Scooters or someplace that had real good hamburgers, and they had cable TV, and you get CNN, and it was a big treat. So it was a fun place. St. Thomas was a fun place. Booze was cheap there, but the cheapest place with booze or electronics and so forth was in St. Martin. Mm-hmm. And St. John. That's a small island. It's Rockefellers owned it, and they gave it to the park department. And, you know, there was a mountain there. You anchor, and you can dinghy ashore and then climb up on the mountain. They had paths up there and look all over. It's beautiful. Mm. It was a nice place. And Joost van Dyck. That was a British place. You could clear customs if you wanted, but nobody's going to bother you. In the Bahamas, now they're getting strict, I understand. Before, no trouble.
Well, Richard, is it in summing this up? What?
No, I'm not through yet. Oh, okay. No, I got another story.
Okay. Can I pause this? And
Angie and I went down through, we met people, we stopped at all the islands going down. She had to go down to Caracas and get her condo fixed up to sell. We got Grenada, in Grenada Harbor. It's even worse than the Bahamas. The Bahamas is all crushed shells. That's all it is, crushed shells. Am I on?
Yep.
It was terrible. You couldn't, in a blow, you couldn't hold. So, and there was a storm coming through, and so we stayed there to go down the next day, or after that, we're going down. So I put the anchors out, a Bahamian spread. You put an anchor out over here, you motor over here, drop the other anchor, and then you pull yourself right in between them. Mm-hmm. That's called a Bahamian spread. Usually that'll hold you, but actually you see them, they moved, and this was a minor hurricane, probably just about 75 miles an hour, and we were sitting on, I had to put the motor on, and I just put it in gear just to keep the strain off the engine lines, and there was a big power boat there, a 50-60 foot power boat, and he had one of his props that bent, and he had one prop, and then he went over somebody's anchor chain, not an anchor line, but an anchor chain, and that did in for his other prop. And he was just drifting. Now, right behind us was a big sandbar. And if you ran into it, all you're going to do is just hang it in the sand. You might tip a little bit, but it's not going to hurt you. And it wouldn't hurt the boat. And I wasn't worried about that. Angie was worried. She's people don't know these things. But I'd been through it before. I knew what was there. I knew what the boat could do. I knew what I could do. But this boat went behind me, big power boat, and he hung up. He went between me and the shore. She says, "Go ahead, forward. Go forward. He's going to run into you." And I said, "If I go forward too much, I got to run over my own anchor line. I can't do that." And he's not going to hit us. So he went back, and he hung up on a sandbar. So, I mean, she got scared crapless. After the storm ended, 4 or 5 hours later, the Coast Guard in Grenada came by and asked if we needed anything. I said, "Yeah, take up one of my anchors and take it over there farther. And so he did that, and then I could pull up on it. And that was great. And we left there. Angie, after the storm passed, Angie plopped her hind end down on the bunk seat behind us where the wheel was, and she just sobbed. She uncontrollably sobbed, she was emotionally exhausted. And we'd been up all night too. That doesn't help. She was emotionally exhausted. But then we went down. We go from Granada, the next point of land is Venezuela, but you don't, but there's some islands between there. That's about 90 miles to Las Testigos Islands. And there, that's where a lot of fishermen go in there and anchor and so forth. And so we went in there, and then we went on down to Margarita, and then we went to Cumana. That's right around the corner from there. And we went in there, and she flew from there over to Caracas, and I stayed there. And then I later locked up the boat and I went up and I joined her, and I got up there and I couldn't make water, I couldn't pass water, I just thought I had an enlarged prostate, but what I had was cancer, and I couldn't pass water. I mean, boy, it hurt. No, nothing. And I went to Caracas. I went to a doctor in Caracas. Nobody did anything. Couldn't do anything. And so we took the plane down, and I'm suffering. Man, that was hurting. And I got down, we got down to Cumana, and there was a urologist down there. And I said, Angie, you got to come with me. I got to go. I got to get catheterized. So he put a catheter in me, and I with a bag. And of course, after I got out of his office, I cut the bag off, and there was a clamp between the end of that and my penis. So I could, if I felt my bladder get full, I just unclamp it and go. I had to go someplace, so I went to I had to get something done. And I thought they'd just do a resection of the prostate. They reamed it out. And that's all they did. But what I had was cancer, and they didn't tell me about it. Took damn near a year later. But anyway, on the way home, Angie, she flew home. And I had the boat in Puerto Plata. And this is a big boat, big mast, big sail. But I put a Genoa up, and I'd put the motor on, and I'd get out, and then I'd put get the Genoa set. I'd set the autopilot, and set the sail so that it would take it where I was going. Set my course. I know what my course was. That's a long trip there. I was going to Great Managua, and that's the lower of the Bahama Islands. They still make salt there. They're a big company that makes salt, has a place there. And I was alone, and just as I was coming to Great Managua, you have your radio on channel 16, and that's an emergency channel, and I just got. And at about 2 o'clock in the morning or something, and this boat hails me and it says a sloop that's headed for Great Naga, we are coming to check you out for a safety check. They don't say they're looking for drugs. They can't. It's illegal. So they say it's a safety check. They see it's your. When they tell you that, you look back and about halfway between you is a hard bottom inflatable with four guys in it with automatic weapons. You don't argue with them. And you don't want anyway, you don't have no quarrel with them. So I put on my spreader lights and open the gate and give them a hand getting aboard. And they saw I was cooperative, and I explained it to them what was going on. And they just gave me a cursory check, and they said, have a safe trip. And I said, thank you. And I went into the anchorage there at Great Managua, and my main halyard had got hung around the upper spreader, and I couldn't whip it off. Usually you could just whip it off in there, it would come off. But I couldn't get it out of there, couldn't get it off. So I was anchored there, and before I could start up, I had to get that halyard free. So there was a guy going past in a dinghy, and I explained it to him. I says, I got a Wilson's chair on board. That's a seat with ropes to it, and you cleat it onto the main halyard, and they crank you up with a winch. And which he did, and I got my halyard loose. I came down, and I figured out how I stayed there another night because I was a little exhausted, tired physically. So I had a sleep, and then I had the next day. I figured out what my chart. I figured out I'm going to Clarence down Long Island from there, and you take your chart and you figure out your distance. How many miles you're going to do? 5-6 knots an hour, and what your course is going to be, and what time you want to get there. You want to get there in daylight. You want to get there in the morning daylight, because the sun's going to come up out of the east, and that's going to be on my west. So I left there and had it on course, and I could see this. There's a place in between the there's. There's reefs over here, and it was Hogsty, and up through here, and it's about 5 miles across, and I could see this power boat over there. It was probably about a 50-60 foot. It was white, looked like it. There's no red slash on it, orange slash on it, the Coast Guard has, So you know it's not a Coast Guard boat. And he was going up there, but I wasn't paying any attention to him, And that morning, here was, right there, this is up in here, this incident happened, and this, the Coast Guard stopped me right along in here. Uh-huh. And I went up in here in Anchorage, and then I was going up to Long Island, Clarencetown, and this guy was dogging me along there, and about 1 o'clock in the morning, he was right behind me. I didn't hear him. And he put a floodlight on me. The Coast Guard doesn't do that. Uh-huh. And I suspect right there what he's going to do. Now, there were hijackers. What they do is they come up alongside of you and rake you in two with automatic weapons, lash the boats together, strip off anything that's saleable on there, and take you back north of Cuba and blow the bottom out of the boat with you in a locker. So that's what happens. I know these guys were. And he put it on there, and he got on the radio and said, "What is your documentation number? Are you making out like he's Coast Guard?" Mm-hmm. And I had suspicions there right in the beginning. So I said, "What?" I gave my documentation number, and he said, "Well, it'll be a few minutes before I hear from Miami about that." Great time. Oh, here we are. Okay, here it is.
And so what happened after that?
I knew what he was doing. And after 20 minutes, I says, "Hey, I don't think you're Coast Guard. I think you're a hijacker." So I got on the radio. I went on deck. I didn't have a weapon on board. All I had was a 5-gallon jerry can for the dinghy motor. And I got to pour that over the side, and he'd been right behind me, and then I got to shot a flare at it. Well, that would have set his boat on fire, and he would have got pissed off at that, and he'd get mad at me, and he wouldn't want that to happen, and you don't want that to happen. But that night on deck is the only time, even during the war, I said, "Tonight I'm going to die. They're going to kill me. Bigger than hell." I don't know who it is. Let him. I think. So the only thing I could do is get on the radio. And I said, this is a sloop carryard. I gave my latitude and longitude. I says, I'm bound from Great Nagua to Clarencetown. And I'm passing through Hogsty Clarence here. There was a... I said, I'm being hijacked. There's a guy that's going to hijack us. And we got, I spoke in a plural. I was alone on the boat. I said, they're going to hijack us. And by God, we're going to take some of them with us. You better call Basra, Bahamas Air Sea Rescue, and the Coast Guard. Tell them there's going to be some bodies floating in here. It won't be just ours. And I said we're ready for them. They wanna hijack us. Let them try it. I'll take some of them with us. I went on like that for 20 minutes. I mean, I was good. Jesus, really. What else am I gonna do? It's all I could do. Mm-hmm. I went up later. 5 minutes later, they're gone. When I got into Riviera Beach later, I had to get out of Miami. I went to the commandant's office. I took my log with me. I told him the story. He said, number one, we don't go in the Bahamas unless we're invited in there. Number two, he says, you talked yourself out of a hijacking. Mm-hmm. I was proud of that.
That was pretty awesome. That was good.
Yeah, I was, I was ready to die. But I didn't. I'm still there.
Well, I've got to run, but
Okay.
It's been a pleasure, Dick. I want to thank you for sharing your memories with
us. All right. Well, that was a good story.
It was a good story. Yeah.
Well, it's in the book. You read it.
I have. Yeah.
Did you read it?
I did.
Well, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Why'd you just copy it off?